I really am excited for you guys to be here. We're continuing a series entitled, Whose Kingdom Have Your Boots Been Under? Whose Kingdom Have Your Boots Been Under? And it's this idea that we are called to build God's kingdom, not our own. That is the greatest calling in life, that we're called to be all about Jesus, to be about His kingdom. And before we even get into anything tonight, I want to give an example of someone that is in our midst that has done an incredible job of building God's kingdom. If you're new here, if this is your first time here, you need to know that we're a church plant. We're 2 years old. And we're a church plant that started with zero funding, no guarantee that this thing would succeed. This has been a complete God story. The fact that we're here today is all because God is awesome. It has nothing to do with any of us in here. And so not only have we kind of survived, but we've actually grown and God's done some great things. But we meet on Sunday nights, not because we love Sunday nights or because we're called to Sunday nights. We meet on Sunday nights because this property was open for us to rent out a space. At the time, there were 9 different churches that met in this property, and the only time slot they had left was Sundays at 6 p.m. So we've been meeting here, but since day one, it's been my prayer that God would give us a building. I knew we couldn't afford a building. I knew there was no way, unless we were 10 years old, we could ever get into a building. So I just said, God, this is your story. Give us a building. And a few weeks ago, God gave us a building. And I want to introduce to you the guy that gets the assist on this. He is a good friend of mine. His name is Chris. And I'm going to ask Chris to actually come on up here tonight. I'm going to embarrass him. Chris, if you could come up on the stage. If you guys could help me thank Chris, show him. Yeah, you can stand up for him. This is... No. You guys can go ahead and have a seat. This is Chris Gill, and I won't embarrass his wife, Kelly, but she's here with him as well. And Chris has played such a huge part in our story. If this is your first time or you're new to our church, what you need to know is that my very first experience with church planning was at Chris's church. And I went to a meeting there, and the next week I had an interest meeting just to see if anyone wanted to help us start a church. And I thought we were going to start in a home. We ended up having 96 people that wanted to come to this interest meeting. So I had to quickly find a church. And I'd never met Chris, but I'd gone to a meeting in his church. And so I Googled his church, and I found a number, and I called him, and he called me back. And I said, I know you don't know me, but I have 96 people coming to this interest meeting. I need a place for them to meet. And he was like, yeah, come on. And I was like, do you have anything going on Sunday night? And he was like, well, the youth meet in the sanctuary, but we'll just kick them out. You guys can have it. And I'm like, man, who is this guy? He is so kingdom-minded, like willing to just let us come in there and take over. So our very first meeting was at Reservoir Church, and that's how I started to get to know Chris. And we've had lunch, we've had coffees, we've talked throughout the years. And for the last 2 years, but he literally was a miracle when he sent me a text about 4 weeks ago that said, would you like a free building on 8 acres of land? And I don't know why you texted me, by the way, and not called me. But Chris is a walking example. He could have easily sold that property and made a lot of money. He could have easily said, hey, we're going to sell all the stuff in there. Just because we have a free building, we own nothing. These chairs that you're sitting in, they're not ours. We own 2 computers, I think, and that's about it. We own nothing. And he said everything stays. All the furniture, all the computers, all the sound equipment, everything stays. And so I know you guys already gave him like a standing ovation, but as a church, we wanted to give him a gift. He's in the process of starting a business, and we wanted to give you a financial gift for thinking of us and being generous to us. And it's not nearly as much as what you gave us, but it's just a token of our deep, sincere appreciation. You are playing a huge part and have played a part in our story, and God's going to use that whenever we tell our story. You and your ministry is going to be a part of it. So I just want to say thank you. Can you guys help me thank Chris again? Yeah, man.
I was not expecting that.
Yeah, man. Thanks. We can just go home now. That was pretty cool. So we're in this series called Whose Kingdom Have Your Boots Been Under? And we're really trying to help each other learn what does it mean to live for God's kingdom. And there's something that I've wanted to talk about, and I don't know why I put it off, but I wanted to get to this Sunday to talk about this because it's an incredible kingdom-minded idea, but it's something that you guys probably aren't even thinking about. We should be thinking about it, but most of you are not thinking about it. And the idea kind of starts with this question that I get asked on a regular basis. And the question is, how come at Next Level Church, you don't do altar calls at the end of your sermon? Now, if you grew up in church, you know exactly what that is. If you did not grow up in church, or maybe your church didn't do altar calls, let me explain it to you. This is what it looked like. The pastor would preach a sermon, and it didn't matter what the sermon was on, but at the end of the sermon, he would throw in there, this is how you become a Christian. So the sermon could be on how to be a great mom for God, and then he would end it by saying, you are a sinner, Jesus loves you, if you want to ask Jesus into your heart, come forward. And I never got how the two things got, we were talking about moms, and now I don't understand, but every week he had to do it, he had to give an invitation. And it never bothered me until I became a staff member at a church that did altar calls every single week. And I am not anti this. There are lots of churches that do it. That is great. I'm not bashing on it. I'm just explaining to you why we don't do the altar call. And it's the reason is because this church that I worked at, I was told, because I was a staff member that worked with youth, that whenever they did the altar call, if there were ever any teenagers that came forward, I had to come up front and meet them and then take them to a back room. Do you know how awkward and creepy it is to walk up to a teenager that you don't know, put your arm around them and say, come with me to the back room. I've got candy. Like, I mean, it is awkward and creepy and weird. But I would take them back there. And then we had like kind of a script that we had to follow. And you had to ask them a series of questions. And one of the questions was like, you know, what brought you here? And almost every time with teenagers, the story was the exact same. I just got kicked out of my school. I just got kicked out of my home. I got in trouble. I got busted doing drugs. It was always some drama type thing where they had gotten in trouble with the law, gotten in trouble at home, gotten in trouble with their school, and they were in trouble. And so their answer was, let me just get to church. And a lot of times the reason they were at church was not because they wanted to be, but because someone had dragged them and said, hey, it's going to look a lot better when you go to court if you tell them you've been going to church, or if you got saved, or their parents said, hey, this is what you need. And so I would listen to their story, and then I would ask them the questions. Have you ever asked Jesus to be your personal Lord and Savior? And they would say no, and I would explain to them what that means, and then it would lead to the final moment, the prayer. You have to say the prayer in order to become a Christian. And I would lead them in this prayer, and then we would actually write their names in the Bible that says, this date, you are a Christian, and you're saved. You've said the prayer. Now, one of two things happened to those students, because almost 100% of the time, after we would say the prayer, they would leave and I would never see them again. I would never see them at church. I would never see them at youth group. We would do a follow-up call, ask them to come back, but I never saw them again. And so I just have a thought about one of two things happened to them. Either one, that prayer radically changed their life. And I'm not judging them. I hope it did. I hope that prayer changed their life in such a way that they committed to serve God for the rest of their life. So much so that he called them to the mission field and they are in the Bunga Bunga jungle, and that's why we can't get a hold of them. That's option A. Or option B is that they are banking on the fact that they said a prayer is the ticket for them to get into heaven. And it just worries me some that there could be literally dozens or hundreds of people that are walking around Hampton Roads that do not have a relationship with God, do not have any fruit that God's ever done anything in their life, do not know God, have never tried to get to know God, have not plugged back into church, and yet because they said a prayer and have a Bible that has a date on it, they are saying, I've got my ticket to heaven. And I don't feel comfortable doing that. And ultimately, though, I would do that. I would get over my discomfort if Jesus said just one time, the key to heaven is to say the prayer. But Jesus never said, if you want to follow after me, say this prayer. Walk this aisle. But Jesus did give some clear things to do. If you want to be my disciple, if you want to follow after me, this is what you do. And yet the church for years has held on to the prayer. Jesus never said to say the prayer, but you know what he did say? He said, build my kingdom. And if you want to know what it looks like to get into heaven, start building his kingdom. That's what Jesus was about. In fact, Jesus said and talked about the kingdom more than he did any other subject. Let that sink in just for a second. He talked about it way more than he ever talked about hell. He talked about the kingdom way more than he ever did money or sex or following rules. It was all about the kingdom. Build God's kingdom. Walk into my kingdom. It's all about Jesus's kingdom. And so the thing that we need to be asking ourselves is not, have we ever said the prayer? And it's not, hey, do I go to church? That's a great thing. You should go to church. But the thing that we should be asking is, what does it mean to build God's kingdom? Because that's what Jesus was all about. And so tonight, I want to show you this through our text. This is a text that may not be familiar to you, but this is a text where Jesus just lines it up. If you want to know that the kingdom of heaven is yours, this is what you should do. And we're going to read it, and I'll explain it, but it's going to come up on the screens for you. It starts off by this. It says, now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him. And I want to stop there just for a second. When it says his disciples, maybe you've heard the word disciple. Jesus had 12 disciples that followed him and did everything that he did. This is not just talking about those 12. It's talking about anyone that was following him at that time. This is a large crowd that has gathered around him. So his disciples came to him and he began to teach them. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, I want to give you a little bit of context from what we're talking about here. This is what is known as the Beatitudes. It is the start of the Beatitudes. Now, if you're familiar with church, if you're familiar with the Bible, maybe you've heard that word before. But if you're like me and you just have never really studied that, you're just like, be what? And when I hear the word Beatitude, I can't help but think of this. That is a bee with attitude, but ba-dum-ching, that's all I got. He's mad. He's angry. He's a bee with attitude. That's what I think about. What does it mean for the Beatitudes? Now, you're going to notice that Jesus never says the word Beatitude. But if you read your Bible, which I encourage you to do, and you should read this section because it's all about the kingdom and all about what we should do. And at the beginning of most sections in your Bible, it titles this sermon as the Beatitudes. What in the world does the Beatitudes mean? Well, the Beatitudes are a set of teachings by Jesus that begin with the phrase, blessed are. And if you ever read this sermon, it is short little sermons within a longer sermon. And each little line starts off with the words, blessed are. And this sermon appears in both the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. And so there are four Gospels that tell the story of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And this sermon appears in Matthew and in Luke, and it's called the Beatitudes, and it simply is because it starts with the words, blessed are. The words, blessed are, come from the Latin word, which actually means happy, or fortunate, or blissful. So when you see the word beatitude, or the better translation, blessed are, this is the word that you should be thinking of. Come on, you can bob your head a little bit. At least put a smile on your face. The song's called Happy, not Your Dog Died. Come on. I want to see someone move around a little bit. There we go. That rose got it. There we go. Come on. Yeah, you can clap your hands. What's wrong with you guys? Happy. Be happy. Smile. It's all right to smile in church. How many of you have heard that song before? How many of you have seen Despicable Me 2? If you've seen Despicable Me 2, you've heard that song. That song is actually a better translation of the Beatitudes than the word beatitude. That song is called Happy. And the idea that Jesus is teaching here is happy are. Not just blessed are, happy are. Now, this is really important to us because I would almost guarantee that if you walked out of here and asked any American, what is it that you want in life? You know what I think they would tell you? I just want to be happy. And then we have a sermon from Jesus that is all about the keys to happiness. Blessed are, happy. If you want to figure out how to be happy, this is what you do. This is what you follow. Read this if you want to be happy. But I need to make sure you understand something. Jesus's understanding of happiness is way different than our understanding of happiness. Our understanding of happiness is fleeting. When we get our way, we're happy. It puts a smile on our face. When we don't get our way, we become sad. And Jesus' understanding of happiness is not a happiness that comes and goes based off your circumstances. It is something that is deep down in your soul. Our understanding of happiness is when someone brings you Krispy Kreme donut and you eat 2, 3, maybe 4 donuts. Is that just me? That makes me happy. Until I wake up the next morning and I get on the scale and I'm like, why did I do that? I'm not happy anymore. Our happiness is fleeting. You get a new car, you're happy. You get in an accident, you're unhappy. Our happiness is fleeting, but the happiness that Jesus is talking about is something that does not leave you. Even when you're mourning, even when you're sad, even when your world is falling apart, there's something inside of you that says, you know what? I am really sad. I'm crying. My heart hurts, but yet I still can find happiness because I know where I'm going and I know whose I am. And whose am I? I'm Jesus's. And it is a way bigger happiness than anything the American dream can ever promise you. And Jesus says, hey, if you want to know the key, this is where it starts. This is where his sermon starts. And I want it to come up on the screens for you again. He says, blessed are, which a better translation of that is what? You guys get a star today. This section is making it happen. I'm proud of you guys. I want to be proud of you guys. So on the count of 3, the correct answer is happy, okay? 1, 2, 3. Happy. There you go. There you go. We're all on the same page. Okay. Blessed are, or a better translation is happy are, those that walk the aisle and say a prayer after church. No, that's not what he says. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, again, I'm not anti saying a prayer. I think that can be very meaningful if you want to ask Jesus into your heart. But I think a better understanding of if you're God's or not is by the fact that he has done something in your life and it changes you. And you can say a prayer. You can say 10 prayers. You can say 12 prayers. But Jesus didn't say, hey, say a prayer and the kingdom of heaven is yours. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit. This is a really important verse that none of us are thinking about or talking about. This is what we should be wrapping our minds around. In fact, I think this is such an important verse. I'm not going to let it go. I want you guys to know this. In fact, I want you to know it so well. We're actually going to memorize the text tonight. Okay? We've done that before. And I want you guys to know that we're going to do it again. We are going to memorize the text. If you're new, you should be shocked. Have you ever been in a church where they memorize the pastor's text? This is what we're doing tonight. You are going to memorize this. And here's how we're going to do it. This is so important that I want you guys to have it in your heart and your brain. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to teach it to you, and I'm just convinced that it is way easier to memorize something if you have motions. So I've come up with some incredibly cheesy but very effective motions, and I'm going to teach them to you. Okay? So the verse says, blessed. Okay? This is our symbol for blessed. You're going to point, because it means happy, you're going to point to your face and make a big smile. And then in the cartoons, when they're really, really happy, their teeth like make a little ding sound. It's like a shine. So you're going to go, ding. Blessed. Okay, are the poor, and at this point, if you have pockets, you can actually do this. You're going to empty your pockets like you have nothing in there, okay? If you don't have pockets, just pretend. You got nothing, okay? So, blessed, ding, are the poor in spirit. Okay, now why did I do a bird, okay? Because when Jesus got baptized, it says that the Spirit ascended on him in the form of a dove. And so, I couldn't come up with another motion for spirit, so that's what you get. Okay? So, blessed, ding, are the poor in spirit, for theirs, you're going to dance, theirs, you're going to point to everyone else, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay? It's all I got. It's all I got. All right. So, we're going to, this is an all play. We're all, some of you are looking at me like you hate me. We're happy, okay? All right, here we go. Ready? I'm going to lead you here, okay? Blessed, ding, are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay? We're going to do it again. This is an all play. I'm looking at you. Ready? Here we go. Blessed, ding, are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay, you guys have done good. Now, we're going to take away your cheat sheet. We're taking away the screen. Everyone stand up. This is an all play. We're going to see if we can do it without the cheat screen. All right, ready? Here we go. Ready? Blessed, ding, are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. All right, now I helped you that time. You're on your own. This is an all play. One, two, three. Yeah. Man, good job. Give yourselves a hand. That's awesome. All right. So blessed. I want you to, even if you can't memorize it word for word, at least remember some of the motions, because this is incredibly important. This is how you know if you're getting to heaven or not. What is it? Happy are the poor in spirit. Why? Because theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, no matter what happens to you in this life, you know I can still find joy in God because ultimately my destination is in heaven. It's not based off your works. It's not based off how good you are. It's not based off your church attendance, even though I think you should attend church a lot. It is not based on a prayer that you've prayed. Blessed are the poor in spirit. So the question we need to be asking ourselves is, what in the world does it mean to be poor in spirit? What does it mean? Because if that's the key to getting into heaven, what does it mean to be poor in spirit? Well, I love what one commentary says about this. It says, to be poor in spirit is not to lack courage, but to acknowledge spiritual bankruptcy. It confesses one's unworthiness before God and utter dependence on Him. I love the wording of that. It's spiritual bankruptcy. It is confessing to God, I am unworthy, and it is having utter dependence on Him. If you were physically bankrupt, you would be utter dependent on someone else to bail you out, to help you out, to provide a meal, to provide shelter. And this is spiritual bankruptcy, saying I've tried everything on my own and it's not working. I've tried everything. I've tried every effort to make it in this world and I am struggling. I have not gotten there. And until you get to that point where you are utterly dependent on God, you cannot be assured that the kingdom of heaven is yours, even if you said a prayer. Blessed are the poor in spirit. So now here's a question that we should be asking. If blessed are the poor in spirit, how do we become poor in spirit? Now, I wish Jesus told us, but he doesn't. He goes on to the next bullet point and says, blessed are, and then lists out another one. So Jesus doesn't tell us how to become poor in spirit, but he tells us that we need to get to be poor in spirit. And so I've been thinking about this and analyzing it and trying to figure out, and all I can go off of is my life experience. And there have been two things in my life that have forced me to be poor in spirit. And these are things that maybe you've never felt poor in spirit. These are things you need to start wrapping your mind around, because this is the only way that I've ever felt literally spiritually bankrupt. There's two of them. Number one, circumstances force you to be poor in spirit. Circumstances force you to be poor in spirit. We don't have time to ask every single one of your story, but I bet you if we went around and passed the microphone around, I bet you a huge majority of us, if we were to say, hey, how did you come to God? What brought you to church? What brought you to come to God? I am betting that a huge majority of us would say, my world fell apart. Even if it was, I grew up in a Christian home and I had Christian parents, that point when it really became real to you, it's when something happened. It's when the words, I want a divorce, were uttered, that you said, okay, I've tried it all on my own. I am failing miserably. I need God. Or it's when you got the doctor report that said you have cancer and you said, man, I've tried to eat healthy. I've tried to stay away from everything that gives you cancer. And yet I got cancer. I'm scared to die. It is bringing you into the presence of God because your circumstances are that bad. It's when you get the words, you're fired and you don't know how you're going to provide for your family. It is when the person says, I no longer love you. It's when they cheat on you. It's when everything you thought in life, the direction that you thought you were going, you thought it was a done deal guarantee, when all of a sudden the door slams shut and you have no one else to turn to, you become utterly dependent on God. Circumstances at times force you into the presence of God. I've had multiple experiences like this. I had a charmed childhood. I grew up in a Christian home, and I love my parents. I had great parents. But it wasn't until I got to college where I really started wrestling with, what does it mean to have a faith of your own? Yeah, I believe in God, but so what? What does it really mean to have a relationship with God? And my life circumstances really made me question a lot of things that I believed. I transferred from this area to Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia as a junior. And when I transferred there, I went through a lonely phase that really caused me to feel spiritually bankrupt. And it may not seem like a big deal to you, but it was a rough few weeks for me. It started when I showed up there. My dad dropped me off, and I had 3 days. I had to be there early, but I had 3 days before class started. And I didn't know a lot of people at Liberty. I knew a few people, but I was transferring in. And so all my friends already had friends and had activities they were a part of. And to make matters worse, they put me in what was called the senior dorms because I was an older student transferring in. So no one was at my dorm. No one showed up for the first 3 days. And when I finally did see people, they all had friends. The only person I saw on my first day on the campus was a guy that opened the door without knocking. He poked his head in. He was about 6'4", 6'5", maybe 6'6". He took one look at me and said, "Hey, I'm going to be your roommate." And I got really excited because I really wanted some human interaction. But then he closed the door as if he was going to go out to his car to get like his luggage, and he never came back. And I don't know if I scared him off. I don't know if he's like, "You don't pass the test. Like, there's no way you're going to kill me." I don't know what he was thinking, but I never saw this guy again. And so for the whole first day, I sat in my dorm room with nothing to do and just waiting for mealtime. And I went down to, it's called the Marriott's, where we ate our dinners. And I went there and I ate dinner by myself. Now, I don't mind doing things by myself. I don't mind going to movies by myself. I don't mind eating by myself when it's my choice. I do not like it when I'm sitting around thousands of other people that are my age and I have a whole table for like four or six and no one's coming to sit with me. And I left that night and I went back to my dorm and I was feeling kind of just sad. Like, okay, I just got to get to class. Once I get to class, I'll meet some people. I'll get over this. It's no big deal. But I really wanted some human interaction. And that night at about 10 o'clock, I was changing into my PJs. And so I did not have a lot of clothing on. I had just stripped off my clothes, and all of a sudden my door opens again. And it wasn't my roommate, it was my RA. And apparently at Liberty University, there's a curfew, and your RA is commanded to check on you at 10. No one told me this, and so my first meeting with my RA is me standing in my tidy-whities and him looking at me. And he says, "I just had to check, are you in your room?" And I'm like, "Yep." He closed the door, and that was my only human interaction for day one. Day two comes, and I ate breakfast by myself. I ate lunch by myself. I ate dinner by myself. At this point, I'm starting to feel a little bit like just kind of down. And the third day comes, and on the third day, I run into a friend of mine from high school. And her name was Mia, and she was she had lots of friends there. She's a junior, so she knew lots of people. And she invited me to do lunch with her. And I was so excited to actually have human interaction. And so I meet her before lunch, and I pick her up in my car, and we drive to the Marriott. And when we get there, there's no parking anywhere. And Mia says, "Hey, just park in front of the Marriott." And so I pull in front of the Marriott, and there's a sign, and it clearly says, "No parking." And I said, "Mia, there's a sign here." And she says, "Well, classes haven't started yet. They won't give you a ticket." So I go in and we have lunch, and it's a great experience because I'm around other people and I'm meeting some people and I'm thinking, this is awesome. This is what college is all about. And I walk out to my car, and on the windshield of my car is a little yellow piece of paper. It is signed by LUPD, which stands for Liberty University Police Department. And it says that I owe them $25 for illegally parking. Now, normally this would get me down because I was a poor college student that didn't have $25, but I was so excited that I ate lunch with someone that this ticket wasn't even going to get me down. Well, the next day, classes start, and I go to my class, and there's no parking anywhere. I drive around this parking lot, and I'm about to be late for class, and the only parking that I see is this row that is facing the building, and that each row has a diamond in it. And I don't know what the diamond means, but I'm just thinking to myself, there's not enough diamond people to fill all these spots. I have to park somewhere. And so I pull my car into a diamond parking spot, and I go to my class. And when I come out of my class, there is a little yellow piece of paper on the windshield of my car. It is signed by LUPD, and it says I owe them $25 for not having a permit to park in a diamond parking spot. Well, my day continues, and I eat dinner by myself, and I go through my night ritual of trying to avoid my RA seeing me naked and then waving hi to him, and pretty lonely stuff. And The next day comes, and I learned my lesson from parking in the Diamond parking spot, and I told myself, okay, I'm going to park at the Marriott where we eat, because then I can just walk from my class to lunch. I'll eat lunch by myself, and then get in my car, and I'll drive back to my dorm. I thought it was a great plan. There were no signs. There were no diamonds anywhere. I go to class. I eat lunch. I go back out to my car, and at my car, there is a little yellow piece of paper on the windshield. It is signed by LUPD, and it says I owe them $25 for parking in the commuter parking lot. I don't know how anyone knows it's the commuter parking lot. I didn't, but I got a ticket anyway. Now, at this point, we're getting close to the weekend, and I just needed to get home. I drove four hours home to just be around people that liked me and would eat meals with me. And I spent time with my family, and I tried to recharge, and I drive back on Sunday. I get back to LU before the curfew at 10 p.m., and when I pull in near my dorm, there is no parking anywhere. So I see this dirt parking lot that is a few hundred yards from my dorm, and I pull into this dirt parking lot, and there are cars everywhere. There's no lines anywhere. There's no signs. People have just parked their cars, and I thought, this is the best I got. I'm going to be late for curfew. I've just got to park my car somewhere. So I park my car near the entrance of the dirt parking lot. I go into my dorm. I come out the next morning. When I come out the next morning, there's a little yellow piece of paper on the windshield of my car. It is signed by LUPD, and it says I owe them $25 for creating a parking space in a dirt parking lot. I'm a little bitter about this. So at this point, if you're doing the math, I owe LUPD a lot of money, and I'm still eating most of my meals by myself. My only interaction is with my RA, and so I'm feeling kind of low. I'm feeling down, like I was feeling depressed. Well, I kept just saying, I just got to get through this week, because once I get through this week, I get to start my job at this little country church that I work at. It was in Farmville, Virginia. Yes, it is a real place. No, it is not based off the Facebook game. And I was 45 minutes away from my college, and I just said to myself, I just got to get there. I got to get to the youth group. I was a youth pastor. I just got to meet them, and they'll like me. We'll have a lot of fun. It's going to change this whole story. And so right before I leave, they call me, and they say they need some flyers from my college campus. There was an event coming, and they said, could I pick up some flyers? And this is Saturday morning, so I said, yeah, I can go pick them up. I drive to the building where the flyers are at. I park my car in front of the building. I leave the car running because the building looks like it's closed down. I open my car door. I sprint to the building. I tug on the door. It is locked. If it was open, I would have parked my car and then gone in the building, but it was locked. So I ran back in my car. I sat down. I closed the door. I put my seatbelt on. As soon as I click my seatbelt, LUPD pulls up behind me. And the officer walks up to my car, and he hands me a little yellow piece of paper. It was signed by LUPD, and it said I owed them $100 for parking in a fire lane. Now, at this point, I am feeling crushed because no one wants to be with me except for LUPD, and they keep charging me lots of money. So I literally cried the entire drive from Liberty to Farmville, and I just thought, I just got to get to Farmville, and it'll be okay. When I get to Farmville, and the first person I meet wasn't extremely happy to see me. Her name was Monica, and it's okay. I ended up marrying her, so it worked out well. But the reason why she wasn't extremely happy to see me was the same reason why the students weren't happy to see me. They all loved the last youth pastor who had graduated from college and had moved on, and they told me that. In fact, that night, I probably heard it 45 times that we love Chris, and we miss Chris, and Chris used to do it this way. And so, like, I left there just feeling dejected and saying, God, what in the world are you doing? And I don't want to ever go through that kind of loneliness that I felt. And maybe it seems trivial to you, but as a college student who just thought, hey, if you walk with God, God's going to bless you, going through weeks of loneliness where you're having to pay tickets that you can't afford, it was crushing to me. And it spiritually bankrupted me. To the point where I got in my dorm room and I'm on my knees and I'm just crying out to God. And I'm saying, God, I don't know what your plan is, but I need you. I don't understand. I'm starting to doubt that you even exist. You got to help me. You got to do something. It was one of the first times in my life that I felt spiritually bankrupt. But there have been other times when we had a miscarriage and I thought that it was God's plan for us to have a baby and that baby died. I was spiritually bankrupt. Nothing I could do could bring that baby back. When I got fired from my job, I was spiritually bankrupt. Are you kidding me, God? I'm trying to obey you. What is going on here? And some of you, the way that you found God is because life circumstances have pushed you to be spiritually bankrupt. But I'm telling you all this to tell you, if you've never felt spiritually bankrupt before God, just get ready, because at some point life's going to hit you and it's going to hurt. And when life hits you, the tendency is to stiff-arm God and say, God, why would you do this to me? Why would you allow this to happen? But God is using that to spiritually bankrupt you, to turn you into a person that is fully dependent on Him. So hear me on this. It is okay to get angry with God. I don't know what your circumstance is. Get angry with Him. Tell God you don't like it. God is big enough to handle our anger. But don't you dare stiff-arm God and push Him away. Because it is only through the presence of God, of being bankrupt with Him, that we can see Him use tough circumstances to bring us on the other side. So the first point is that life circumstances bring us and force us at times to be spiritually bankrupt. And there's a second point. And the second point is simply taking a holy risk for God forces you to be bankrupt before God. If you're here today and you've never gone through a tough situation, a hard situation in life, the only other way that I know how to feel spiritually bankrupt before God is to take a holy risk for Him. And you might be wondering, well, what is a holy risk for God? Well, a holy risk is doing something that you cannot do in your own strength, but it is to build God's kingdom. A holy risk is not just saying, oh yeah, I should leave everything and move to Hollywood because I want to be famous. That's not about God's kingdom. But a holy risk might be, I should quit my job and start a business because God is leading me to build His kingdom through this business. A holy risk. It is something that is outside of your mind. It is something that you're saying, man, I would never dream of that on my own, but I keep having this nagging feeling that I'm supposed to take a step, a leap of faith. I'm supposed to do something, and it feels scary. And God, if I do this, I can't do it on my own because I'm going to fall. I'm going to fail. A leap of faith might be telling your neighbor about Jesus, or telling your coworker, or telling your boss, or asking someone at work, hey, would you like to do a Bible study with me during lunch? That's a holy risk. You're scared. They might reject you. They might make fun of you. That's a holy risk where you cannot depend on your own strength. Praying a big prayer and saying, God, if you don't come through, we're going to fail, is a holy risk for God. Signing up to start something new that God might be leading you to do is a holy risk for God. And if you want to know, if you don't want to go through the first step of going through hard life circumstances, if you want to know how to take a holy risk for God, start asking this question. What would you try if you knew you could not fail? What would you try if you knew you could not fail? There's a great chance that whatever that is that you would try, there's a great chance that that is God speaking through you, but you're not going to do it because you're afraid. But it is taking that leap off and trusting God and saying, hey, even if I fail, I'm in your presence, God. I don't know the details. I don't know how you're going to provide, but I'm taking a leap because it is bigger than myself. It is a holy risk. And I'm telling you, the only two ways I've ever felt spiritually bankrupt is when life forced me to be, or when I took a huge leap for God. It's the only way I've ever felt it. And you get into a circumstance where you're like, God, I don't know. I do not know how to fix this. I don't know how you're going to provide. And you watch what God does. It's where you find spiritual bankruptcy. I want to close by giving an example that Jesus actually gave that models what spiritual bankruptcy looks like. It says, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable, and I want to stop there just for a second. There's a group of people. They were religious people. They'd gone to church a lot. They knew the Bible a lot. They'd memorized some verses with motions. And they did a lot of things for God. And they felt so proud of saying the prayer and checking off the list and reading the Bible that they looked down at everyone else who didn't match their standards. And Jesus sees this and it disgusts him. Look at what Jesus says. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. If you want to know what it looks like to be spiritually bankrupt, become like this tax collector who humbled himself and said, God, I am a dirty, rotten sinner. Without you, I am a failure. I've tried everything. I can become a success by just working really hard, but even that success will lead me to misery. God, I am nothing without you. God, you are so big. I am so small. I'm going to attempt this, and I'm scared to death. I need you. God, woe is me, a dirty, rotten sinner, that you would use me to change the world. If you don't want to know what it looks like to be kingdom-minded and to be poor in spirit, it's this tax collector. So the question tonight is, what are you going to do with this information? Because according to Jesus, it's pretty important, because blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Not blessed are those who said a prayer, walked the aisle. Blessed are the poor in spirit. The question is, have you ever been poor in spirit? Let's pray. God, thanks for this day. Thank you for being an amazing God that loves us and that does provide and helps us even in tough circumstances. And God, I just ask right now that you would be bigger than the messes that are represented here. I ask, God, that you would be bigger than our problems, bigger than our struggles. And God, I ask that you'd be stirring up desires to do something for you, God. That you would be planting dreams in our minds, that we would attempt something, a holy risk for you. And God, for those that are really struggling with real life issues, God, I ask that you would hold them, that you would be stronger than their desire to push you away. I ask that you would use all of our life circumstances right now to draw us into your presence, God. You are greater than any problem we can face. You are greater than any achievement we could ever have. God, you are God, and we ask that you would lead us into your presence so that we could become spiritually bankrupt for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.